all rise. Division 29 of the 16th Circuit is now in session. The Honorable Jeanette Rodecap presiding.
Please be seated and maintain order. Good morning, everybody. Today is February 1st, 2018. We're here on our landlord-tenant docket.
The landlord-tenant docket at the Jackson County Courthouse downtown is also known as eviction court. It's where landlords take cases against tenants who have fallen behind on rent. And the upshot can be families losing homes. That means kids like Raven Marion have to change schools.
It was hard to adapt to new kids. The way the schools are set up, it's hard to get more involved with teachers, students, and get along.
Raven's mom, Fran, withheld a rent check when her landlord didn't respond to complaints about a broken furnace in the middle of the winter. But when her family was evicted, Fran really had to scramble, and the whole family went through a series of dangerous and uncomfortable situations before finally settling back into a new apartment.
I'd rather go through toothaches and childbirth again.
Eviction is an issue that's finally starting to get people's attention, and there are a few reasons for that. One is an 18-year study showing just how high the eviction rates in Jackson County really are. It's pretty bad, but also as rent continues to climb in a lot of urban neighborhoods in particular, concerns about the availability of affordable housing are growing. So today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll start with eviction, and then later we'll discuss the related issue of affordable housing. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined now by Tara Raghuvir, who did that study I just mentioned on eviction in Kansas City as an undergrad at Harvard. Hi, Tara.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me.
So we spoke last January, and there has been new information since then, which I'm excited to hear. But start by giving us a recap of that original study, the questions you were asking and what you found.
Sure. So I'm a Kansas City native. And as you mentioned, when I was a senior at Harvard doing my thesis research, I decided to come back to Kansas City to study the private rental market and specifically eviction in the private rental market. And I was doing this mostly as a result of my understanding of the affordable housing crisis right now, wherein the most vulnerable people in our country actually aren't receiving federal subsidies anymore, but they're left to the hands of the private rental market. So I came back in 2013 and 2014 to begin my research. And then since we last talked last January, that study has expanded quite significantly to a data set of 18 years of data. These are all eviction filings at the address level. It amounts to about 189,000 eviction records. And we've done a lot of analysis. And we also have an update on the 2017 data that's hot off the presses.
So first of all, when you say we, who are you talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the beginning, the research was my kind of individual senior thesis project. Since then, I've been able to recruit a team of data scientists who are extremely talented to work with me on answering some of the more nuanced questions about the data set and what it can help us understand about how evictions and displacement impact the city. And in addition, in the last year, and even since we last talked, I've built relationships with folks all over the city, direct service providers, attorneys, organizers, who have helped me further understand the implications of the data for people who live in Kansas City and what can be done next.
So, Tara, let's talk about what the data is first, and then I want to hear about some of those questions about what it all means. I mean, okay, so the data as of 2017, what did we know?
So as of last year, basically, I was able to access this data set of 189,000 records, all at the address level. And these are from the Jackson County courts. So it's just Jackson County data, but it can help us understand a little bit more deeply, of course, how eviction impacts the entire city. What we know from 1999 through 2017 is that there's a crude average of 42 evictions filed per business day and about 25 eviction judgments that are actually made per business day in Kansas City or in Jackson County specifically. So the distinction there is that evictions are filed, but there's not always an eviction judgment made. But of course, 25 are made per business day. And one really important qualifier before we move on is that these are only the formal filings that make it to the court. So these numbers do not represent the informal evictions that happen outside of the court system and with no data to represent them.
So just the note on the door.
Exactly. Just the note on the door. And my research tells me that actually this is a fraction of the evictions or forced displacements that are actually taking place.
25
many, many
a
more.
Day. I mean, 25 a day. That is truly disturbing. That's 25 individuals or families with no place to call home.
That's right. That's 25 families who are actually receiving a judgment. And it's worse than, you know, just the fact of them being displaced from their home. A judgment means that you have an eviction on your record forever that any of your future landlords can look at. It also means that you might be displaced away from, you know, easy access to your job. And your kids may be displaced from their schools in the middle of the school year. And again, those are only the judgments that are made through court. So that 25 figure, I think, is actually extremely conservative.
So when you talk about at the address level, what is it that you are telling us there?
Yeah, so we're basically able to see the eviction trends over the last 18 years, almost two decades, block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood, making this one of the richest data sets on evictions in the country. Previously, when I was doing this research in 2013, the best I was able to access was zip code level data, which is helpful, but not as granular as this. And now we're able to see, you know, a property in a particular neighborhood that's dealt with a mass eviction and kind of trace, okay, who's the property manager? Who's actually the owner of that property? Has it changed hands? It allows for a much more detailed study of who's evicting and who's being evicted in Kansas City.
But it seems like also it's following the address, not the tenant.
That's right. But all of the court filings data includes information on both the plaintiff and the defendant, so the landlord and the tenant.
So you've said that since your Harvard thesis was turned in, this is something that kept you up at night. It continued to keep you up at night. Can you explain a little bit more about why that is? I mean, I'm curious about whether the situation here in Kansas City, how that compares with cities across the country.
Yeah, I think, you know, my answer has two parts. One is that it was deeply personal to me. I grew up in Kansas City, but I grew up in a part of town that fortunately is not impacted by the kind of ravages of eviction and poverty. So when I came back to do my research on eviction in Kansas City and I found myself just 10 minutes away from where I'd grown up and where my parents still live, but kind of contending with a totally different reality and speaking to low-income people and people of color who were experiencing kind of a different city entirely, that shook me to my core. And I wasn't really able to forget about some of those people that I had formed relationships with through the research process. And then the second part of my question, to your point about whether or not Kansas City is an exception, Kansas City is actually not an exception. And there's not great research on eviction nationwide, although we've taken major strides with Matthew Desmond's Eviction Lab having released, you know, millions of records across the country. My analysis tells me that Kansas City is not an extreme in terms of being extremely high or extremely low on our eviction rate. But that presents an opportunity and an urgent one. And I think Kansas City has a responsibility to act boldly and urgently to address the affordable housing crisis and the eviction crisis before it's too late. And for some cities in this country, unfortunately, it is a little bit too late already.
What do you mean by too late already?
You know, there are cities like Seattle, Denver, San Francisco, New York, where the crisis has gotten to the point where low-income folks and people of color simply can't afford to live in the center of the city. They can't get to their jobs. And even middle-income and white folks are struggling to make the rent. And in those types of cities, there's not a lot of room to expand. There's not room for new construction, and there are few policies that could really turn back the tide that's taken them over. In Kansas City, per my analysis, we have a couple of amazing resources that we can't forget. One is that we actually do have space, right? We've got a sprawling city, a sprawling metro area that allows us to think about some creative solutions for the affordable housing crisis. We have vacancies across the city. We have housing units that, but for some basic rehabilitation, might be extremely, you know, livable places for folks who are impacted by the affordable housing crisis right now. In addition to that, I feel like Kansas City has this other resource that's easy to ignore but super important, which is that we have a concentration of philanthropic and private capital in Kansas City that a lot of other, especially Midwestern cities, simply don't have. And I think all of those resources need to be leveraged in the direction of solving this crisis.
So you've said that you have updates since a year ago. What's happened since a year and a half ago? We talked last January. What have you learned that you didn't know then?
So last January, I was talking on this program about my senior thesis research and some of the quantitative, but mostly the qualitative learnings that I had gotten through that process. In about April of last year, I accessed this much, much richer data set, which allowed me to do a deeper analysis about who's impacted, as I said, at the address level. One of the key findings there is that race is an incredibly important factor, in fact, the most important factor in determining whether or not someone in Kansas City will be evicted. It's the most important factor even when we hold income constant. White people are evicted much less in Kansas City than Black folks, and we know that from the deeper kind of statistical analysis that we were able to do with some demographic data with that data set.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely troubling, although it's also pretty predictable. Unfortunately, America's nasty legacy of racial injustice endures in the housing market. This is not unique to Kansas City, but of course, Kansas City is one of the birthplaces of discriminatory real estate practices like redlining and, restrictive covenants. And I think as a result, it's only to be expected that some of the impacts of that are still with us today. And this is what we can see in the eviction data in the private rental market.
Is when that you look- bias on the part of landlords, bias on the part of judges?
I think it could be both. Unfortunately, we're not yet at a point where we can draw causal lines. But of course, you know, it could be bias on the part of the landlords. It could be bias on the part of the judges. What we see when we look at the map is that evictions are concentrated east of Troost. And of course, those of us from Kansas City know that Troost is kind of the historic racial dividing line in the city. One thing I think is important to call out, too, is that in my qualitative research, what I found is that landlords that rent to a low-income market oftentimes select into that market because they're selecting into the market that's the most vulnerable or the easiest to exploit.
When you say selecting into the market, I mean, you're saying that they are that this is kind of predatory, or is that not what you're am I putting words in your mouth there?
No, that's absolutely what I'm saying. There's at least, you know, a core of landlords in Kansas City and nationwide who approach the affordable housing market or the low-income housing market as a predatory venture. And unfortunately, we see this in many other sectors in the economy. And again, I think we have some important parallels in Kansas City even. We've got payday lenders in Kansas City that are lending in a very predatory manner. And similarly, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that at least some of the racial story of the disproportional impact on Black folks in Kansas City is about predatory practices.
You've talked about that part of what made you stick with this project beyond the moment when you turned in your thesis and got your undergraduate degree, that you continued to study eviction in Kansas City because you couldn't forget some of the people you had met during that project. Can you tell us maybe a couple of those stories and take us through what this new information tells you about the trends that those individuals represent?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one couple I met when I was doing my research that really impacted me was an elderly couple. Their names were Chuck and Ivy. They were both in their mid-80s. Chuck was a veteran, and they had both worked their entire lives. And at the point that I was talking to them, they were receiving, just over $12,000 a year in veterans assistance and some Social Security benefits, and it just wasn't enough to make ends meet. And actually, they had been displaced from the core of the city out to kind of the sprawl of the city and were living in a manufactured home or a mobile home. And the landlord that they were working with at that time just continually was raising the rent and charging them extra fees for things like their dog or, you know, having stuff on their lawn. And it got to the point where in December of 2013, when I was meeting with them, they were facing an eviction. And these are two old elderly folks who really had nowhere to go and nobody to turn to for help. So it was their story that really stuck to my bones and kind of I wasn't able to forget. But more recently, you know, I think I'm really struck by some of the local reporting that's come out of the rich conversation that started to develop about displacement. And I'm struck even more by some of the stories of families with children in schools. And the connection between evictions and student mobility is crystal clear. Students are losing, you know, up to 3 weeks of instruction time because of their family's eviction. And that is absolutely horrific. And that lost instruction time has implications for student outcomes that obviously stay with them their whole lives.
And for all students in those classrooms. I mean, our reporter Barb Shelley has done incredible in-depth reporting on this student mobility issue, on kids switching schools midstream throughout the year in really high numbers, and the really detrimental effect that has on education. Eviction is a big part of that whole problem. And I'm curious, I mean, looking at 18 years of data, I mean, can we say a generation out how eviction affects not just individuals, but entire communities?
I think we're getting to that point, and this is part of what's been, you know, so thrilling about the work that we've been able to do in the past year. We've entered into some amazing partnerships locally that, like I said, kind of add a level of nuance to the story about eviction and how it impacts our city. So, for example, we've started signing data sharing agreements with Kansas City Public Schools, Grandview, Hickman Mills, and a couple other school districts so that we can try to tie the evictions data set to a data set about students and student outcomes. And that's allowing us to begin telling this story about what the actual impact is on the Fuller community, even beyond the individuals who are evicted themselves. We're not all the way there yet, but soon we'll have some more thorough analysis on the school side of the story. And then also, I think it's worth mentioning that in the schools, in the courts, in direct service, there's a real, you know, fiscal cost to the city of conducting so many evictions every year or having so much displacement in the city. And I think sooner rather than later, we'll be able to get to putting a dollar figure on the amount of money that evictions are costing the city of Kansas City, Missouri, every year. And hopefully that will be a catalyst for some real policy change.
I mean, there's this Kansas City Eviction Project that you are the director of, but it's a collaboration of city leaders, educators, social service advocates. Does having even just something called the Kansas City Eviction Project make solutions more feel within, I don't know, within the realm of possibility?
Absolutely. The last year has been kind of a whirlwind of these incredibly rich conversations with folks working locally who have been working locally for a long time that help us deepen our understanding of kind of which questions to be asking of the data and what that tells us about policy implications. And I'm under no illusions, right? Like I said, the data set is limited inherently because it's just the formal court filings. So it's just a fraction, really, of the evictions in Kansas City, although it helps us understand part of the story. But the other part of the story that, you know, local actors are helping us fill in is the story about the schools, right? So Barb and colleagues at KCPS have been really incredible about helping us tie that story together. And we've got colleagues who are working in the courts, who are at that landlord-tenant docket every Thursday morning, who are helping us understand the role of the judges and the role of attorneys in bringing these cases. And we've had a bunch of meetings, too, with folks at City Hall to understand the policy measures that have already been taken to help impact this problem and some of the potential measures that we might consider moving forward.
Such as?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think, you know, one of the aspects of our research that lends the most direct policy implications, I think, is our story about what actually goes down in the courts. So we have a pretty detailed story, and we've done a zoom in on our data from 2006 to 2016, and we're looking at about 100,000 eviction filings, 72% of which actually end up going through the process in the landlord-tenant docket. And what we find is that 99.8% of the time, the landlord wins, leaving 0.2% of the time for a tenant victory.
Why is that? Why is the landlord winning so often?
At least a large part of this story is about who's represented in court. Only 1.3% of tenants have representation by an attorney, whereas 84% of landlords are represented by an attorney. And representation matters. So the tenants that are represented have a higher win rate than those who aren't. It's actually significantly higher versus all the folks who aren't represented, who are basically guaranteed an eviction when they step in the courtroom. So one of the policy takeaways here, I think, is that we can follow in the footsteps of other cities that have pursued right to counsel policies, and that's kind of a citywide mandate. So New York City has kind of stepped out ahead of everyone else with the most progressive policy here, but basically they've guaranteed a municipal right to counsel for every eviction trial that happens in the city of New York City. And I think that's certainly something that we could pursue in Kansas City. They've done fiscal analysis in New York City that shows that it's actually much cheaper for the city to do that and provide guaranteed access to counsel for everyone going through the process than it is otherwise, because it's costing the city so much money to evict folks.
Well, this seems like a good time to bring Jane Worley in on this. She's the supervising attorney at Legal Aid of Western Missouri, which provides legal representation to some people in Jackson County facing the possibility of eviction. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. What insights do you have on this, especially at the court level, as someone who sees what tenants are up against, both as they try to stay in their apartments and then once they're potentially thrown out?
Well, as Tara said, it's devastating for families. We have tried to keep the level of evictions down, but I think that as long as the laws in Missouri are as landlord-friendly as they are, that it may be difficult to change the eviction rate in Kansas City.
Give me an example of a landlord-friendly law.
Well, it's really easy for landlords to evict people, and it's very quick. For instance, they're only required to give a tenant 4 days notice prior to the court date if it's a rent and possession case, and that's for personal service. So that doesn't really give that person very much time to either get their rent together or find an attorney to represent them. So one of the things that Legal Aid has done is we've started appearing at the docket call each Thursday afternoon just to catch those people that need help, and there are a lot of them. There are people come off the elevator on the 7th floor at Jackson County Courthouse just totally bewildered and unable to even figure out where the courtroom is.
So you go and find them where they are rather than, because 4 days, that really...
Yeah, it's very short. Yes, that's what we're doing.
What other laws in Missouri would you consider landlord-friendly?
Well, also, it's really difficult to defend against a rent and possession case. Basically, if you owe any money at all that's rent, that means that the judge can give the landlord a judgment for both possession of the property and whatever money they owe, even if it's as little as $30. There's no lower limit.
Tara, what can you say about this?
Well, two things that come to mind hearing Jane's reflections. One is that she's talking about a particular eviction case type called rent and possession. And one interesting thing that we find when we look at our data is that it appears as though evictions have remained relatively stable for the last 10, 20 years, around 9,000 filings per year. But interestingly, when we break that down by case type, we see that there's been a consistent uptick in the number of rent and possession evictions filed in recent years. years. So that number has actually risen to about 6,563 in 2017. That's a 6% increase over 2016, and it's the highest on record. So the reflection that I have about that is that, you know, the affordable housing crisis is really starting to grip Kansas City. That's previously been understood to be an affordable city, and this is consistent with nationwide trends where it's becoming more and more unaffordable to live in every city in the country. And the second thing that I'm reflecting on hearing Jane talk is that one of the other interesting factoids that we've gotten from our 2017 deep dive is that we're seeing more and more landlords show up to court and filing evictions that are actually multi-state conglomerates. So these are ownership entities that kind of hide their fuller footprint in Kansas City under LLCs or limited liability company names. So there were 4,000 LLC filings last year. That's a 30% increase over 2016 and a 311% increase over a decade ago, meaning that the impact of these out-of-state LLCs that kind of hide who exactly is responsible for the filing is growing at an extremely high rate.
You know, Jane Worley, as harrowing as the data itself is, what do you see when you work on this issue at the individual level, like when you're working with particular clients of Legal Aid of Western Missouri, that the data might not fully capture?
Well, that's a good question. I see that people who are at a level of poverty where even the slightest glitch causes them to be evicted. I mean, if they have a car problem, if they have medical bills, if they have a higher utility bill than normal, they may lose their housing over that. And another thing is that if they get behind on their rent, then the late fees that are charged by the landlords are exorbitant. And for instance, a lot of landlords charge $100 late fee if you're late more 1 day. And then every day after that, it's another 10 bucks. So they can't ever catch up.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for sharing those insights.
You're welcome.
And Tara Raghavir, director of the Kansas City Eviction Project, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a deeper dive into that affordable housing piece of the question. Is affordable housing getting more scarce? How is that affecting you and your life? Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll start taking those calls in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, looking a little more closely at affordable housing. We like to talk about it like it's this crown jewel of our Midwestern city, but affordable is a relative term, and rents have been noticeably climbing in a lot of neighborhoods throughout the metro. So call 816-235-2888 if you have a personal perspective to share on the search for affordable housing and what that term even means. I want to start with Doug Cowan. He's with us from the Community Services League. Hi, Doug.
Hi. So great to be with you guys today.
Thanks. How do you interact with this question of what is and is not affordable in the work you do?
Well, you said it right. It's a relative term, and there's so many ways that you can go with this conversation around affordable housing. And when I talk to folks about the concept of affordable housing, one of the things that may often first come in a conversation is, well, to what extent do we want the government or other policy to dictate the rent or what is affordable? And I like to start with, to make it a broader conversation, what the government's historic role has been in helping to make housing affordable in the United States. And I think one thing that we look at today that we all sort of take for granted is the mortgage interest deduction for home ownership. And we subsidized mortgage interest to the tune of $70 billion a year for homeowners across America. $70 billion a year is more than our defense budget. And so I think it's a great place to start our conversation to show that our country has been in the business for decades of subsidizing housing, promoting good quality, affordable housing, whether it's rental, whether it's home ownership. And so there's so many different ways to intersect with that. But our country has largely been in the business of trying to figure out how do we get people into good quality, affordable affordable housing.
Daniel Serta of Insight Planning, chime in here. I mean, what is the role of quote unquote affordable housing in how a city functions? What a city is like to live in?
Well, if you think about how people make choices about where they live, where they work plays a large factor in that, the kind of amenities they expect, the quality of the neighborhood, where they're going to send their kids to school. All of those kinds of factors influence someone's choice of where they live. But really, the determinant factor is what's your income? Because you've got to make a selection based on what you can afford. And that's where, you know, affordability becomes an equation for everyone in terms of what you're going to be able to do. One of the hard realities of the 2008 recession was that there were some folks, particularly in suburban areas, that did not really adequately contemplate the possibility that they might lose a job. And you had real challenges with foreclosures. The most profound foreclosure crises in the United States back in 2008 were actually primarily in suburban areas and areas that were rapidly growing and rapidly developing. So that's a huge factor in all of that. But again, ultimately, people are really usually choosing based on where they're going to work and their ability to get to work and to get to the amenities and services that they need day in, day out.
So when we talk about affordable and we look at Kansas City as compared to other cities, you know, people do talk about it like, oh, this is a more affordable city to live in by comparison. Is there something we're missing there?
There is. I mean, usually we gauge affordability by what you pay in terms of housing costs. But there were studies that started about 20 years ago out of Chicago, an organization called Center for Neighborhood Technology, that made the point that you have to look at your total cost of living. And the other major expense that all of us have every day is transportation. And so cities like Kansas City, they're very sprawled out, where we tout as, you know, one of our defining features, the affordability of homes throughout the metropolitan area, you know, especially in comparison to relatively expensive cities on the coasts. You know, you can buy an incredible house, great yard, and a great school district for $200,000, say, you know. Once you add in the costs that everyone faces on a regular basis of owning and maintaining two automobiles, we don't look quite as affordable as a city that, say, has much higher levels of transit accessibility or is much more compact or has shorter commuting distances at times. And so that's a huge issue. Another quick factor, yeah, Gina, that has to be taken into consideration is energy costs, the cost of operating a household, and that's water and that's electricity. And unfortunately, we have relatively high costs in that regard, especially within Kansas City, Missouri, specifically.
I also wonder when people look at the relative cost of housing, mm-hmm, do they also look at the relative average income?
Well, even if you do, it looks pretty good. But again, it's not just the cost of housing by itself that has to be taken into consideration. But that being said, yeah, we're in a differently structured housing market. That actually raises some challenges in terms of solutions that have worked in other cities where the issue is much more about a constrained supply. We have a lot of land. We have a lot of availability. Where you start seeing challenges about supply and rising rents, especially is in areas that are neighborhoods that are growing really quickly and areas that are becoming a little more challenged in terms of the ability of existing owners and renters to remain where they are as prices escalate.
Well, this is when I want to bring in Sarah Gish. She's with us from the Kansas City Star, and she's written an article about something that's going on right now. You know, in November, the Missouri Housing Development Commission voted not to allocate $140 million in funding for the Missouri Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. I'm going to let Sarah explain that shortly, but she's written an article about how that might affect folks wanting or needing to live downtown. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, in your article, first of all, you tell the story of a guy named Joe who worked as a valet while he worked toward a career in engineering, just like getting his career off the ground. And he found an apartment downtown for less than $400.
Right. That seems like a dream come true for a lot of people who want to live downtown, probably. But what he found was an income-restricted apartment, which is available only to those who make less than a certain amount of per year. The amount changes every year. At the time that Joe got his apartment 3 years ago, I believe it was $31,600 for him to move into this apartment in the Crossroads District. And it was less than $400, which was in his budget. And he used that extra money that he had every month to pay down student loans, medical debt, and he also worked towards getting a job in the career he went to school for, which was engineering. So he went from being a valet and a bartender to having a job as an engineer, and now he makes too much to stay in his apartment, and he's actually moving with his fiance to Roland Park. So what I wanted to do with the story was to kind of talk to people who use these income-restricted apartments, specifically downtown, which is the area that I cover, to kind of get a step ahead in life. And I found some people who are making a career change, who might not have, you know, the income to afford the market rate apartments, or who are saving up to go back to school. And as just going back to the tax credit thing, developing that kind of housing is going to be a lot harder moving forward without those tax credits. Because
yeah, explain what those are.
So the tax credits that were provided by the state that were essentially eliminated, those give investors financial incentive to develop low-income housing, because otherwise, it's not very financially enticing because the rents are low. There's not a lot of money to be made there. But what the investors can do is use the tax credits to offset their tax liability. So moving forward, developing affordable housing downtown could be challenging because developers don't have the financial incentive to do it. All the apartments that are, you know, scheduled to be built now, there's more, I think 5,000 market rate apartments either planned or under construction for downtown Kansas City. And next to none of those are for low income residents. So what you're going to see over the next several years is the makeup of low income residents to people who live in market rate apartments is really going to change.
So Doug Cowan, tell me how this plays out beyond downtown.
Well, I think that when we look at housing, I oftentimes talk about housing as a platform to economic opportunity. I think Sarah hit on that in the article. She followed Joe at the particular point that he was at in his life. Housing was able to vault him into certain areas. And that's where we really look at housing as that platform. Because when we see families that are the most troubled families that rely on places like Community Services League or other type of social supports, typically their housing stock is very poor.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the physical condition. We know that housing helps, unfortunately, poor housing leads to continuation in poverty because a lot of times the houses are old. They may still have lead paint. They may have mold issues. They're not energy efficient. To all the points that Daniel talked about earlier, they're spending, the residents are, even though you may look at it and say, wow, that's an 1,800 square foot house, and all of a sudden your utility bill is $500 a month because there's really no weatherization. So having good, affordable housing is absolutely critical for people to be able to use that as a platform to move ahead in the world.
So you've added a word here, and I think it's an important one, not just affordable housing, but good affordable housing.
Absolutely. And that's what, as Sarah talked about, the tax credits have been able to do is not only does it give the developer an incentive, but a lot of times we're talking about, especially in downtown, we're talking about revitalizing really old buildings. And you don't have to think very hard about all the costs that you're going to run into rehabbing old buildings. And so the developers are taking quite a bit of a risk. And if we want them to maintain some level of affordability, and what I've been most inspired about, and I'm sure Sarah has seen this in her work and her coverage of downtown, is a really a grassroots call from the residents themselves of downtown saying, we want a downtown that is open and accessible to all ranges of incomes. We don't want downtown Kansas City to be exclusively high income earners. We want a nice cultural mix, and so affordable housing can help do that.
But Daniel, what about this question of how it's playing out beyond downtown, shaping just, I mean, where do we still have places that have affordable housing, period? Or are people really having to scramble?
We do, but those areas are tending to get pinched now at both ends. I mean, they have the same kinds of dilemmas that Doug was alluding to, where the physical quality of the housing is very challenged. The energy costs are extremely high. But now you have development pressure, where you have market rate developers wanting to come in and build relatively large numbers of market rate units in places that did not have them before. And that's putting upward pressure on rents and upward pressure on the tax burden.
We are about to bring your calls into this conversation. You can still join in at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about affordable housing in Kansas City. Where is it? Stay tuned. I'm I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about affordable housing in Kansas City as the rents in a lot of neighborhoods continue to climb. I'm here with Sarah Gish of the Kansas City Star, Doug Cowan of the Community Services League, and Daniel Serta with us from LISC. He's also a new project manager for the KC Catalytic Urban Redevelopment Initiative. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah and Doug.
Hi.
Hi, hi.
So let's get back, as we turn to our callers, to this big picture question. Just what is at stake for a city? It's clear what's at stake for an individual in finding affordable housing. What's at stake for a city in having affordable housing?
Well, it really has to do everything from the stability of existing households, their ability to stay and know that they're going to have stability in the neighborhood that they're used to, that they've lived in a lot of their lives. It has to do with people being able to find good quality housing near where they live that's convenient and accessible to where they live. And it really has to do with the quality of life that people face every day.
Let's talk to Sharon with us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
What do you want
Thank
to share?
Thank you for having me. Well, I was just introducing an idea from Milwaukee. Over the past 10 years, they have installed on an annual basis, or on a three-year basis, really, about 1,500 new units of housing for lower and moderate income buyers and renters. And this is really stabilized many of the neighborhoods there in the city of Milwaukee. This was done with a lot of public-private partnerships and tax incentives, but it has been utilizing modular housing brought in from about 100 miles away. They have a good producer of housing. This is high-quality single-family and multifamily.
Yeah, I want to get some reaction to this, Sharon, because it sounds like what we hear a lot is that we have huge availability of housing stock, and people raise that as sort of an argument that, well, we have this thing that we can leverage, but Doug, you have pointed out that housing does not mean good housing. And so Sharon is telling us that Milwaukee has found a way around this through public-private partnerships.
I think that's a fantastic opportunity. Community Services League has a lot of service locations in Independence. And Independence is just like many other areas in the metropolitan area. You think of first-ring suburbs. You think of places like Independence, North Kansas City, Kansas City, Kansas, North Johnson County, Raytown, many of these cities that surround Kansas City proper. And that was where a lot of growth happened post-World War II. And so there were huge homes that were going to build these new families that were largely, many of them were returning from war, going back to school, building families. The baby boomer generation was raised in these homes. The homes were put up very quickly. By today's standards, they're pretty small. And unfortunately, we see a lot of these houses have fallen into deplorable conditions. And in a state like Missouri, that laws really favor property owners' rights as opposed to renter rights, there's not always a lot of opportunity for recourse against property owners outside of just general code compliance. And so what we see here is the opportunity to develop units that help families grow, help young families grow, access good schools, good neighborhoods, a lot of opportunity there.
Let's talk to Drew in Lawrence. Hi, Drew.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What about you?
So I just wanted to try and provide a little bit of perspective within a specific demographic. So I am a case manager. I specifically work with homeless veterans around Kansas City. I specifically take Wyandotte cases. And
Wyandotte County.
Yes, Kansas City, Kansas, Bonner Springs, and Edwardsville.
Yeah, go on.
So one of the issues that I encounter when working with my clients is we're getting a lot of people that have been either literally on the street or in shelters, and much of the time they live on fixed incomes, so say VA service-connected disability or Social Security income or some sort of pension. What ends up happening, because I can't disclose which program I work for, which organization, I would get fired for that, but what ends up happening is a lot of the time, because we are a temporary program, they can't end up sustaining the housing because it falls, the benefit they get every month falls below fair market rent.
So fixed income becomes an issue as cost of rent goes up.
Yes, and specifically for veterans. Veterans are some of the most vulnerable population when it comes to homelessness, and as well as being unable to afford rent, as well as facing evictions. It becomes a slippery slope. Now, if it were up to me, because of the fact that in Kansas, Section 8 vouchers and other types of subsidies are very difficult to come by right now because there's a long waiting list. If it were up to me in terms of implementing some sort of policy, I would want there to be a veteran or military military-specific voucher. Now, I understand there's a FASH voucher, but that only HUD-FASH, which is a collaboration between HUD and the VA, but that only targets populations that have had homelessness episodes four more times and have been homeless for more than a year.
Yeah, Drew, thank you so much for this observation. And I want to give Daniel Serta a chance to respond to this on two levels. First of all, this fixed income issue. But secondly, Drew is talking specifically about Wyandotte County, which is a community that you have a lot of knowledge about. Right. And I'd love to hear how this is playing out.
There's lots of different examples of this, but I would lump them all under, and Doug can probably speak to this a little more specifically. I mean, there's not just a need for housing with a lot of disaffected populations. There's also a need for supportive social services and for reinforcement because the kind of issue that Doug was describing. And again, that's one of the reasons why the dispensing away with the state level low-income housing tax credit is policy from a policy perspective so problematic. That kind of incentive is not just needed for developers to build the housing. It's also needed to create an environment where, from a cost structure, you can develop the kind of supportive housing environments that are required, especially for targeted populations, very deserving populations like veterans that are suffering with a lot of other, both, you know, health, whether it's healthcare, mental health issues, substance abuse, whatever the case might be, a whole range of other issues that need attention.
Let's talk to Jack in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I was wanting to speak briefly about some of the changes that have taken place in Kansas City, especially when we look to downtown. I'm a Kansas Cityan, and there was a time when I worked downtown that I wouldn't stay there past 5 o'clock for fear of my life. But today, it's vibrant, and what's gone on and what we're seeing is this issue of gentrification, which has now moved throughout the downtown area, is moving south, has gone into Beacon Hill and further east into East Crossroads and Crossroads, and we're seeing it continue to move further south, and we're losing, as a result, a lot of the affordability of residences, particularly single family, in the southeast part of Kansas City. And where your speaker spoke specifically to Troost, which has always been the dividing line, as a segregation dividing line for years, that's virtually vanished and has moved over to Paseo now.
Yeah, you know, Jack, we have very little time left, and I do want to get some response to this question about gentrification. Sarah, I'd like to start with you since you raised downtown.
Right, yeah, the price of construction and developing and land downtown has gone up dramatically in the past several years, which is why it's so hard to get affordable housing created there. And I think what you're going to be seeing in the coming years is that ring around downtown maybe starting to develop and become a little bit more quality affordable housing. Like, for example, there's $30 million worth of HUD money going into the Paseo Gateway project, which is only a mile from downtown in the historic Northeast. And that's mixed income housing. So that might be one possible solution to the rising cost downtown, is to do more development just right on the peripheral, you know, the area right outside downtown that has good, solid public transportation to downtown for people who work there.
But won't that just be sort of a ripple effect where you start seeing the same things that happened centrally kind of rippling out?
For sure, yeah. If the city and, you know, people don't make it a priority to get more low-income and affordable housing downtown, people are going to just be pushed farther and further out.
Doug, any other insights on this?
All great thoughts. Like any issue, we need to have good community dialogue about this. And, you know, all of our lives are affected by housing. And so housing is something that needs to be an ongoing community discussion.
Well, our time is up. But Doug Cowan, Sarah Gish, Daniel Serta, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And special thanks to Barb Shelley, who's done so much reporting on eviction and school mobility recently. We've really benefited from that this morning. If you want to share this conversation with someone who missed it, we'll have a link ready for you by the end of the day at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we all archive all of our shows, including yesterday's discussion about a new all-girls charter school opening in Kansas City in 2019. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, meet the local couple whose Court TV show was nominated for an Emmy, and you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.